service or a large amount of junk traffic sent towards some piece of infrastructure. And in any case, it causes things to clog. It causes things to become overloaded. And when things are overloaded, then the service or the network access that someone is trying to provide is defeated. So the service is denied, activated by money. So that if you are so inclined, you can find people these days who will take out your competitor on the net by destroying their service in a sort of controlled financial way, and they get paid for this. So this is no longer just the realm of small IRC users becoming upset with what somebody else said in the channel. This is now a competitive threat. This is now one business attacking another business. So another very, very easy introductory slide. Some of the students in E1 may be getting flashbacks about now. The DNS is the one thing that, if it breaks, everybody knows about it. All the help desk phones ring and the internet is down. All the services go down at once, because without the DNS, you can't find anything. And there are three main components of the DNS. There are authority servers, and then skipping to the bottom, there are resolvers, and in the middle on this slide, I've used this term intermediate mode resolver. This is not a very widely known phrase. Bill Manning uses this phrase quite a bit to describe the function of the server we're going to see on the next slide. And the main reason I'm using this is because IMR is nice and small and it fits on a diagram. So IMR, the intermediate mode resolver in this little presentation, is a caching resolver. So it's the name server that the ISP runs for their clients. So this is how basically it works. We have a resolver on the left on this diagram. The resolver is someone's PC, typically. And it generates a DNS request that gets sent to one of these intermediate mode resolvers, a resolving cache, a DNS cache, call it what you will. And that cache will, if its cache is empty, that IMR will then send requests to various authority servers to find out the information it needs so it can return some kind of answer to the client. And the client, in this case, is the resolver. So the IMR does have a cache. So frequently requested questions can be answered from the cache if the answer is fresh enough. So our diagram just got simpler. We have a resolver on the left sending a question to an IMR, and the IMR is returning an answer of some kind. So the real basis of the attack we're talking about today is source spoofing. Without source spoofing, this doesn't work. So very simply with that diagram, if I'm an attacker, I send what looks like a perfectly normal request to the IMR, but instead of using my own source address, I change the source address in the request packet to use a victim's address instead. So the response, when it's sent from the IMR, doesn't come back to me, it goes towards the person I'm trying to attack. Now, when this happens, for the victim, this is a junk packet, and normally the victim will just throw this thing away. So it's not the actual contents of the packet we're worried about, it's the fact that the packets are being sent at all. So if you add some amplification to this diagram, if I send a very small request which happens to have a very large answer, then the packets that are sent towards the victim are much bigger than the packets I send to the IMR. It's possible if you send a very small DNS request and ask for a resource record that's been specially crafted to be maximally sized to get 60 times amplification here. So if you have one attacker sending a stream of, say, 10K towards an IMR, if the answer is being returned is nice and big, you can effectively get 600K being sent back towards the victim. This is just from one attacker. Now, 60 times amplification looks fairly small when you consider what you can do if you organize an army of attackers to try and exploit all kinds of resolvers across the internet. So instead of just one IMR, you might have thousands, and instead of just one attacker sending queries, you might have 50,000 attackers. And when you do that, the size of the arrows pointing down at the bottom towards the victims get very large. So quite straightforwardly, you can attack a victim with a very large amount of traffic, and none of the attackers need to source very much traffic at all. 10K bits per second would be plenty to launch a massive attack at some infrastructural part of the internet. So I get the feeling from the last couple of weeks here in Nairobi that there is some perception that denial of service attacks are a problem that affect other parts of the world and not Africa. And while a lot of African content is hosted outside Africa, and content tends to be the target of this kind of thing. There is an argument to say that this is currently a problem that affects people outside Africa more than people here, but that doesn't mean that it's not an African problem too. And there's two aspects to this. Part of it is that because you don't need to send much traffic to participate in attack, you can have clients here in Africa, even with very small upstream bandwidths, that are able to contribute very, very happily to an attack on some target somewhere else. The other thing is that content in Africa is moving back into Africa as the infrastructure improves. And of course, you still get attacks launched at clients. It's not just content servers that get attacked. So it's an African problem as well as any other kind of problem. It's an internet problem. So the impact of being attacked is that individual hosts or routers or links can be brought to their knees. You can cripple an upstream network. You can cripple a service for a long period of time. These attacks can last days. If you imagine a business that relies on having a web server up because all your orders come through the internet, then imagine what would happen if that thing was down for a week and really you could do nothing about it. It's a serious problem. Because the attack is so widely distributed, it's very hard to trace it back to its source and stop it. From the victim's perspective, the traffic comes from a very large number of IMRs, which are being used as amplifiers. Contacting all those IMRs and asking them to stop is not easy, particularly because those are services that probably the ISPs concerned need to keep up, because all their customers rely on them. So you can't just turn them off. From the point of view of those ISPs that are running the IMRs, the traffic comes from a very large number of sources, say 50,000 botnets spread around the world, 50,000 hosts in a botnet. And the people who are actually running the hosts that are doing the original attack packets are usually sort of a grandma reading email. And if you call her up and complain and say, you're attacking me, and I'm from Africa, she's not going to know what to do. Even if she understands and believes you, she's not going to be able to fix it, apart from just turning her computer off. So what can we do? Making the traffic stop is difficult because there's way too many people to contact. Unless you have a very, very high-profile service, chances are you don't have the resources to be able to track down exactly who's launching this thing. Distinguishing the bad traffic from the good traffic is sometimes possible because, for example, you usually don't get very many DNS responses that are that big. So if you're getting a 4-kilobyte response, those are fairly rare. You can probably block those in the network. But then again, the resource records and the data which is being sent as part of the attack can change. So you're chasing a moving target. You could block DNS replies altogether, but then, of course, everything would break because you need the DNS in order for the internet to work. So it's not a simple problem to answer. So this seems like a fairly recent problem, and it's, I suppose, in terms of the scale of recent attacks, it's made the news more than it has before. But it's a reasonable question to say, how is this possible? The internet is supposed to be big and reliable. How is it possible for this to happen? So let's examine a few of the things that are required for this attack to happen. So what do the attackers need? They need a source of large resource record sets on authority servers. They need some IMRs, which will perform recursive lookups for everybody, so they're open recursive caches. They need some botnets, and they need some bots, which are able to spoof requests. So the bots in the botnet need to be able to send things with fake source addresses. And this really is the recipe for making this sort of attack work. So if we look at these one by one, to make a large resource record set, sometimes people will just register a domain very quickly. They'll throw a couple of big resource records into it. And effectively, after the attack, the domain is thrown away. It's probably registered with a fake address. It's paid with a stolen credit card. It's effectively untraceable. Sometimes you get authority servers which are vulnerable because they're running old versions of software or the operating systems are compromised. And people can just insert big records into an existing zone. To some extent, you can removing delegations, basically removing a domain or editing the zone file to remove the resource records, is one way of stopping the attack growing. However, once those big records are cached in the IMRs around the world, the attack's going to continue because the authority servers don't get consulted very long. You can imagine if you were designing an attack like this, you'd probably use a time to live on your records that is very big. So you want your records to stay in the cache for perhaps a year. So effectively, there's ammunition for this attack that can remain for a year after the records and the DNS are removed. Now, some parts of the DNS feature large resource record sets intentionally. They're not put there just to launch attacks. And removing some of those can be quite difficult. And here's an example. If you ask the question AOL.com and you ask for its MX record, the query at the top is very small. It's about 70 bytes. It just says AOL.com MX. And the answer you get, which is all this part down here, is very large. Now, in this case, you can imagine, if you're being attacked with resource records amplified through AOL servers, calling up AOL and asking them to remove their MX record may not be a very successful plan of action. So some of these records are required in the DNS, so it's not an answer just to pull these out. So next on our list, open IMRs, open resolvers. Many IMRs, and probably many run by people in this room, will very happily perform recursive queries for anybody on the internet, not just their own customers. Now, this can be useful sometimes if you have a customer that's changed their web hosting provider and they're complaining that some of their customers in one town or customers of one ISP can't see the new web page. It's useful to be able to send queries to their IMR to be able to see what the answers are, how long those records will remain in that cache. So for debugging, this can be useful. If you have roaming users, this can also be useful because users can have one set of configuration, and whether they're using the wireless here or they're dialing up from home, it's the same. They use the same name servers. So that can be useful from a support point of view. So for some people, closing these things down is difficult. However, many of them can be restricted. So it's not that difficult to restrict the resolver that you run at an ISP so that it only answers questions that are sent from customer addresses that are local and not from the whole internet. However, this is still not really an answer to the problem, because even if all IMRs were closed, there's still authority servers. Now, you can't close the authority server down and say it only serves a small part of the internet, because by design, they have to serve everyone. These are the sources of the authoritative data in the DNS. And you can still amplify through an authority server. If you send a query for a non-existent domain to any authority server, it'll reply with a referral to the root, which is the biggest size packet you can get with DNS transport over UDP without resorting to EDNS0. So it's still an amplification. It's not 60 times, but it might be 5 times. So even if all IMRs were closed, we still have behavior that's required to be supported in the DNS that we really can't change. So that's not really an answer to stopping these attacks. Next one, these attackers need botnets. So perhaps we can just eradicate all botnets. And I think probably as long as people are using desktop operating systems which have security holes, there will always be botnets. I don't see much argument against that. So basically the day when there are no more bugs in software, then we can relax. So it might take a while. There is a community, well, more than one community, but this is a notable one, a community of people, engineers from different ISPs, who spend a lot of time every day chasing down bots. They find the command and control servers, and they close them down. They track DNS records. They look at NetFlow records and try to identify the source of packets. They send big lists of compromised Linux and Windows machines and other kinds of machines as well to various private mailing lists, and together they work together to close these things down. So for those who have not heard of NSPSec and are interested in learning more, there's a URL at the bottom, which I'm sure you can get from the slides when they are made available on the web page. Again, this is not really stopping anything. This is not stopping the botnets from being formed. This is just closing them down a little bit sooner than they otherwise would be. So it's a kind of a mitigation strategy. So what's left? Well, if you remember back to the list of things that are required, the only thing that's left is the requirement for the bots themselves to be able to send packets from an IP address. And this is not 20 years, which have relied on the fact that many PCs, many hosts on the internet can send packets which are sourced from a different address than the one they've been assigned. So this is not a new vulnerability. So ideally, this would have been closed down years ago, but of course, it hasn't, as we know. So the most recent IETF document on this subject is BCP 38. Those that were at the workshop last week, there was a workshop on BCP 38, a practical exercise, when Gertjan generated all kinds of junk traffic, and it was the job of the people running the network to try and close it down by applying access lists and things. Now, reading RFCs is not everyone's idea of a good time, so I've summarized it in one slide. So if the source address isn't genuine, and you can tell that it's not genuine, drop the packet. And that more or less applies everywhere. It applies to packets coming into your network especially, because you want to be tidy and save the next guy the job if you can. If the source, if you can drop it, that's what it amounts to. If everybody on the internet did this, this attack would not work. And there would be no such thing as a denial of service attack of this kind. Now, there's a problem with this. That sounds very simple. Everyone just deploys it. However, the problem with BCP 38 is that basically what you're doing by making sure your customers can't spoof packets is you're protecting other people's infrastructure. You're not actually protecting your own. So for you to actually deploy BCP 38 in your network, it costs money. The money that you spend by deploying it gets you no extra revenue, and in fact it helps your competitors, because your competitors get attacked less often. So this does not, on the face of it, add up to a very convincing business case. However, as we've seen from a large amount of attacks in the past little while, the internet is hurt by this stuff. You get prominent authority servers that are taken down. You get nodes of prominent content hosts which are taken down. Yahoo nodes go down. Google hosts nodes go down. Lots of parts of the infrastructure are damaged by these attacks. And if the internet is damaged and it becomes the sort of network that you can't rely on, then to some extent we're all out of a job. So there's some motivation there. Also, the cost of dealing with attacks is high. So it's in your interest to make the internet a less dangerous place for people like you when you host content. So if you encourage other people to do the right thing, it will eventually save you money, because the money you spend on trying to track down these attacks and mitigate them will be reduced. So it's not necessarily as hopeless as it seemed on the previous slide. In fact, I think there will come a point, if these attacks continue, and I see no reason why they should stop, the ISPs will refuse to peer with people who don't do BCP 38. That gives an ISP some financial incentive, because if their options are, we either send this packet over the free peering link to the exchange we already connect to, or we send it over the expensive transit link through our local telco, then suddenly there's a reason there to do the work to make sure you can send the packets through the peering connection. I also think that if it's not happening now, then soon, content providers will refuse to buy service from ISPs that don't do BCP 38. So if you're a big web hosting company, or a university, or a government department, you'll put as part of your requirements, I want BCP 38 compliance. And the note at the bottom says this prediction, of course, can be self-fulfilling quite simply by people in this room actually starting to do these things. It's not always practical, but maybe by starting to ask these questions now, it will become commonplace. So here's some advice for how you can help stop the problem getting worse. If you have a choice of internet access suppliers, and one of them does BCP 38, or at least understands what it means, and the other one doesn't, give your business to the guy who understands BCP 38, because it's better in the long run, especially if you've got a big budget, because ISPs like to listen to government departments much more than they like to listen to individuals. So if you do this, it increases the cost of not deploying BCP 38 for ISPs, because there's an opportunity cost of the customers that they can no longer supply. Other things you can do, be tidy. Don't let packets with somebody else's IP address escape from your network and get sent somewhere else. Put ACLs on every interface. When you see an interface on a router that faces a peer or a transit provider or a customer, and it doesn't have an ACL, then that should sound alarm bells. You should figure out what ACL makes sense and apply it. Fundamentally, if you are an ISP, do not let your customers spoof their source addresses. And a legal answer here won't work, because most customers are not doing this maliciously. Most customers don't know their Windows machines have been infected, so they're sending spoofed addresses without being aware they're doing it. So just putting it in your terms and conditions to say you must not do it won't actually stop it happening. You actually need a technical solution to stop the packets from being sent, or at least stop the packets from continuing to be sent after they reach your network. Now, if you are UUNet, or if you are Teleglobe, or if you are a very large ISP that has a large number of multi-homed customers, rolling this thing out might be expensive. You might have a very large network. You might have acquired many smaller ISPs over the years and none of the networks are quite integrated, and everyone's a little bit afraid to try and throw access lists on routers. For smaller networks, a lot of those costs don't happen. Most customers might be single-homed. You might have a very, very good idea about what address space you have because customers don't typically bring their own address space. In regions such as Africa, they tend to ask the ISP for addresses. So for African ISPs, arguably, it's much cheaper to deploy BCP38 and much simpler. So it should be much easier to deploy this in this continent than it is in, say, North America or Europe. So what tools do we need? Not many. I think probably those who have been in Philip Smith's workshops, or at least one or more of them, have heard of Unicast RPF. Philip, do you cover Unicast RPF? Kind of? Well, if you didn't, then you can always ask your money back or go in a... If you don't know what it is, then you can look it up. It's an automatic way of applying a filter to an interface that says, if I receive a packet from this interface where the source address doesn't match, then drop it, even without configuring individual access lists. And there's two modes, and you can read more about this afterwards. If your network's not very big, you can do manually maintained access lists. And unless you have a lot of customers with their own Afrinet space, chances are that those access lists won't have to be changed very often. So it's not a very expensive thing to do. If you have dial-up users, which authenticate through RADIUS, or PPPoE users, it's possible with many access concentrators to send an anti-spoofing filter in RADIUS as part of the standard reply that says if the packet is sourced from an address different from the one that I give you, then drop the packet. And that's usually a one-line change on many vendors. And as I mentioned, there was a BCP38 workshop at this meeting, and if you didn't see it this time, then I encourage you to make noise for the next meeting and make sure there's a similar workshop there so you can try these things out in real life. So that is pretty much it for my presentation. That explains what these attacks are and why they happen, and really the only recourse we have to damp them down and stop them from happening again. So are there any questions? Alan. You might want to talk into your desk microphone. Or just squawk. I'm told that the usual motive these days for people to start these attacks is money. And most of these attacks are being launched by people who are being paid to run them. Running these big botnets of 50,000 hosts and making sure they're all available at any time to launch an attack is a fairly resource-intensive operation. And it's no longer just teenagers in their bedrooms who do these things. These things are motivated by money. So, as I said before, if you host content, if you have competitors, then at some point you are at risk from being attacked by this thing. I'm sure there are other reasons for attacks, and you can't easily classify every possible reason when you don't know the minds of the people who are launching them, but money is the main one. So if you can ever imagine anybody trying to steal a customer from you, then I guess it's possible that you could be attacked.
Yeah, I'm assuming that by applying filters to block IP addresses that are not genuine, an ISP would typically filter their entire network number as opposed to particular unicast addresses, in which case I'm wondering if the BCP38 would actually stop the same customer or customers of the same ISP attacking each other.
Well, there are... it's on, good. There are different places in your network that you can put filters in order to make this sort of thing happen. If you put them on the interface that faces the customer directly, then one customer can't attack another customer using this approach because they cannot get a packet into your network that has the wrong source address. If you take the approach that what you're really trying to do is protect everybody else on the internet and maybe a few packets between your own customers is okay, then you can apply a filter towards your transit provider. So it's a trade-off. If you do one filter towards your transit provider or towards the exchange, or hopefully both, then it's a very simple and quick thing to put in. Just say no packets that are not sourced from my ISP block of addresses are allowed out. But at the same time, there's a potential risk, I suppose, that you could have junk traffic inside your network. It depends on what kind of network you have as to whether that's going to be a problem or not.
Question? So you say that network administration should avoid the customers to be spoofed. So how can one avoid a customer to be spoofed?
Well, if you're the ISP, then usually you are the one who assigns the addresses to the customer. And if you assign the addresses to the customer and you receive the packets when they're being sent out, then you are the only person who can know for sure whether that packet is being sent from the correct source address. So the ways, the actual ways and the things that you type into your router to make this happen, I didn't put in this presentation because I only have 45 minutes. I can see you afterwards and give you some references. But generally what you do is you apply an access list that says if the packet doesn't come from the address that I gave the customer, then it's wrong. I'll drop it.
Time for a 3-minute confession. Okay, I'm Mark Elkins from co.za, and about 2-3 months ago, we got this strange phone call from some American large organization or company. Apparently, some domain in co.za had a TXT record in it, which was a load of garbage, but it was around about 2,000 bytes long or something. And we knew nothing about that. We did some more research. We discovered at the end of the day it was exactly this type of attack that was going on. The domain was owned by some lady who obviously didn't seem to know what the internet was. The machine she had a domain on had been compromised, which is why the authoritative DNS records for that domain had been changed. And meanwhile, a large American organization had been taken out because of this one particular domain. From a CO.ZA point of view, we were able to remove the domain. We were also able to get the machine eventually fixed, but the time to live was something like 40 days or something, so we did our bit, but that didn't actually help the situation too much. So this checking of what IP address space you've got and what you're sending out to your neighbors and your upstreams really is the only answer.
Do we have any more questions? We have none. There's something that Joel said about he didn't have enough time for putting the slide. All the slides that he has are actually on the AFNOG website, so you can actually get the notes and the presentations. That's right, for the whole tracks, isn't it? Yeah, so the details on the site, and any questions, afnog.org. afnog@afnog.org. You can send questions on there. I'm sure you get the responses. Thank you very much. Our next presenter is Gaurav Bhajia, again an AFNOG tutor, and I think this is his third time down at AFNOG during a tutorial. Gaurav runs the NPIX, the NOC PCH. And also works in the Asian region, and runs the I think the Sanog and Apricot workshops. So we get some interesting. This is also part of what we're trying to do with AFNOG, the relationships and the linkages from the different network operating groups. Gaurav.
Thank you, Badra. I'm glad to be back at AFNOG and speaking at conference. As you said, this is my third time at AFNOG, and I really like the way it's growing. And I'm personally involved with other NOCs, and I really like being at AFNOG. Having said that, my presentation is listed as DNS Anycast on the program, but what I'm going to talk mainly about is best practices in IPv4 Anycast routing. And what I want to make clear about is Anycast is more about routing than DNS itself. And that's it. On the FNOG mailing list as well, we see these announcements about Anycast root server being installed somewhere. And for a lot of people, it looks like Anycast is equivalent to DNS. And that's probably the reason my title is actually termed as DNS Anycast. And thus, to make it clear, Anycast is actually not a protocol, or nor it is a different version of IP, or nor it is a different special capability in the protocol stack or anything like that. It is just a way in which things are done. So what is Anycast? It is just a configuration methodology, as I like to call you, or it is an architectural decision on how you actually, you know, announce your IPv4 routes. It has been mentioned, Anycast has been mentioned in a lot of RFCs, most notably in RFC 1546 in 1993. That was a host Anycasting service. But then, more recently, by Joe Abley and Curtis, in the new draft, Operations of Anycast Services, and that draft expires on 28th of July, and then probably you'll find a version 4 of it, right, Joe? Yeah. So it's probably going to be an RFC sometime soon. So that is the most latest RFC to document Anycast, and we can talk about that later. But then Anycast has been in operation for quite a while. Almost since 1995, 96, people have been using Anycast. Yes, Randy, something? Okay, 1992. It has been used since 1992. A lot of people are actively using it, but then, as I said, it has been only recently documented by Joe and Curtis. So how does Anycast work? The idea behind Anycast is really, really simple. You basically announce multiple instances of the same service from different locations, right? So, and once you do that, once you announce the same addresses, service address from multiple locations, routing will take care of how your packets actually reach those service destinations. So what little complexity that comes out of that is in the details. So Anycast is actually really simple. You take a service address, announce it at multiple locations, and then as routing works, routing will take you to the shortest destination. Or the if you look at a BGP routing table, then if there are two or more, the same prefixes coming out of two or more places, the routing will decide that, okay, this is the closest prefix, we'll go there, right? So the other details about how you actually synchronize the content, how files are transferred back and forth, that is the detail. That is not really, you know, something really complex. Let's look at an example here. I've got two same server with two instances, server instance A and server instance B, other router, and then there is a client. Now, let's look at there. I've got both servers with the same service address, or 10.0.0.1, and then, but the routers have multiple IP addresses, or different IP addresses in both these places, right? The next hop routers have a different IP address, whereas the first, the servers, have the same service address. So next is the client wants to get to the server, does www.server.com, it gets a reply saying, okay, the client is at 10.10.0.1, right? So that is how it works, standard. Now, the next step, the client then sends a packet to the router saying, I want to go to the server which is located at 10.0.0.1, right? So from this router perspective, it is getting two routes to the same IP address, right? One from this router, the other from this router, on this router. So the immediate next hop router is seeing two paths to the same address space, right? So it's just like it is coming from two different paths. This router won't know that these are two physically different servers located probably in different parts of the world or different part of the network. So this will just look at it, look at the routing table and say, oh, okay, there are two hops. One goes to single hop, the other path is two hops away. So for this router, it'll just make a decision, okay, this is a shorter path if I go on this way rather than this way, and sends the packet the shorter path, on the shorter path. So here you see? So this one is the second one, which is two hops away. This is the first one. So that is one hop away. So everybody can tell. The router will decide, I'll go take the shorter path. Right? Doesn't really matter where how it ends there. So that is Anycast. The most simple way to explain Anycast is that's it. Right? Now, the more but there are ways in which you can build this infrastructure. As an ISP, as a DNS service provider, or content provider, you know, Anycast is done by routing. But how do you actually synchronize the servers? What are the techniques you can do? You can actually do Anycast within an IGP, or you can do a BGP Anycast. So these are the details that will actually take some time for you to, you know, work out. So let's go into that. And that's what I wanted to talk about a couple of best practices on how you can design Anycast networks. So as I said earlier, Anycast can be used for building content distribution system, DNS servers, you know, all sorts of things. And FRoot is very commonly known as Anycasted server. There are other root servers which are Anycasted, as well as a lot of CCTLDs and even content distribution system. So how does it work? Typically, a cluster of servers share a common virtual interface attached to the loopback device and speak an IGP routing protocol to an adjacent BGP speaking border router. The server may or may not share identical content. So if you go back to my earlier example, we had two servers with the same IP address, right? So then people will say, how can two devices on the internet can have the same IP address? That is not possible, right? You can't have that. Can you have two devices with the same IP address on the internet? Yes? No? But I had it there in the diagram earlier, right? So how does this work? So what you do with the IGP is you cannot have two devices with the same physical subnet. As long as they are separated by a router, it's still okay. The only thing is you have to find a way to route packets to the appropriate server. Right? If you put two boxes, you'll start getting conflict of IP address messages. Right? But how do you get to that server is something that is handled by the routing system. So what you do, you actually assign generally the way it is done. It's not the hard-coded way to do it, but generally what we do or what is recommended way of doing is you assign the service address to the loopback, right, instead of the interface. So you assign the service address that you want to do Anycast to the loopback of the device or the server, and then use some kind of IGP with the next hop border router, right? So let me explain this in more diagrams. So let's look at this example here. So I've got three servers here. They all have Ethernet interfaces with different IP addresses, right? 1.2.168.1.2, 2.2, and 3.2. And they have a loopback assigned with the same IP address, right? All three have loopbacks with the same IP address, right? This is the service address. This is the interface address. That is the distinction between the two. Your DNS is an address and not to this, right? And then you connect all of them to a router. Works? Makes sense so far? Right? This will not generate any conflict. If this is just in the loopback. Loopbacks don't talk to each other or are not supposed to talk to each other. Right? Now, you've got this thing here. Now, let's go to the next diagram here. So, what you do is you actually run an IGP. Right? Most often, people are using the routing daemon, either Quagga or Zebra, to announce the loopback service address to the next hop border router. Right? So you can run some kind of IGP, either OSPF, IBGP, whatever it is. It's your network design between this server here and the router here. And then the server can announce the loopback address to this router. It can be done with any IGP. It doesn't have to be, you know, OSPF or IBGP. I generally use IBGP for practical reasons. So this router now sees multiple paths to the same service address. This router here is seeing multiple paths here. If you look at this, then it is seeing 10.0.0.1, 1, 1, same prefix, three different paths, same distance. Right? With a different next hop. So this router now has the ability to decide if it gets a packet destination with this IP address, then it can send to either three of those, right, depending upon how your IGP metrics are working. So there. So it can either do a round robin automatic load different service address, or you know, you can tweak your IGP to say that, okay, in case more examples, building larger Anycast nodes or Anycast networks, much larger ones. How can you do that? Once a cluster architecture has been established, additional cluster can be added to gain performance. So that is how the example I showed earlier is a case where building an IGP Anycaster system, or it's just one cluster. Right? It can be cluster with one server and one router, just one server. Multiple servers with the same service address, any number of things. Now, how do you scale that? At just one location, that is probably not what you wanted to do. That's not what you want to achieve with doing Anycast, is just put the service in one location. It is useful if you are an ISP and are trying to distribute servers across the network in an IGP, that is fine, but you want to build a global Anycast network. So what can you do? So let's look at this example again. Again, this the example from earlier where you had three servers with the same service address, one router. Now we've increased the number of routers to three, or increased the number of clusters to three. So something like this, region one, region two, region three. Take Africa, Asia, and Europe, or whatever. So this is, again, what you are seeing here. You are seeing a 10.0.0.132, which is these three servers with the same service address that is being announced from this router. This is also announcing the 192.168, which is the interface address, and then is also announcing the covering routes, right, for the entire 192.168 address space. This makes sense? Right? So there are three, the same cluster is now, you know, being announced at three different places. The earlier example is now being announced in three different regions, and that is being fed into the routing table. So this is, again, in this case, we are doing IGP announcements. All the announcements are going out, including this three. Now, the difference what we have to see here is, in my earlier example, this had 192.168.1, 2, and 3 as their interface addresses. Now, you need to have unique interface addresses. Otherwise, how do you actually access the servers? What you are Anycasting is the service address. The service address is being announced from multiple locations, multiple servers. But you still need a way to access those servers, do management, transfer content. For that, you still need a unique identifier. So in the second case, we actually have 5, 6, and 7. So these interfaces are now 5, 6, and 7, or any other globally unique routable IP addresses, and same thing here. Right? So what happens now? You see these announcements for the service addresses being fed into the BGP routing table, but at the same time, you still got unique IP address interface. Right? This is now a summary. Instead of three different IGP, we've got one. So this is what a cleaned up announcement would look like. You're announcing a set of one globally Anycasted service address, which can be a /24 or a /32 if it is an IGP, and then a set of other IP addresses which are unique, either in the BGP or in the IGP. So this is your service address, this is your interface addresses that are being fed into the routing table. Make sense? Does this make sense? Or is it getting too confusing? If it's getting too confusing, just stand up. Okay. These are now some of the issues that you actually have to look at when you are doing Anycast. is performance tuning. Right, so what are the issues that you actually run into when you actually do DNS Anycast or Anycast any kind of service? Right, so what you have to look at is look at the cost and efficiency. So maybe putting two servers or two different set of Anycasted instances of your services might be cost effective, but if you are putting 10, then it might not really be cost effective. For the DNS root servers, because they want rich and have a lot of servers around, a lot of people, so it makes sense for them to put a lot more servers around the world so that people can have faster access to the servers. But if you are a content provider, right, you'll definitely look at, well, does it make economic sense for me to design this Anycast network and put it out in different places? So it's basically a trade-off between absolute cost and efficiency. The network will perform best if the servers are widely distributed, either with higher density in an area where the demand is very high, right? So if you look at the root server distribution in Africa, I think there's two in South Africa and one in Kenya. Is that right? Right. So those are the bigger population centers in Africa, I guess. But if you look at, say, in Europe, you'll see a more distributed instance where there are root servers in almost all the major cities or the major exchange point where people tend to exchange traffic. And the root server operators and other DNS operators have made this conscious decision about, okay, this is where the demand is going to be, so we'll put the servers there instead of putting it in random areas. So it makes sense to put it closer because you're trying to provide faster access, so it makes sense to put it closer to the people who are going to access it rather than putting it, at random places. Or at places where it is beneficial for you to put it. I've seen that happen. If you look at the Bay Area map, San Francisco Bay Area, I think there are 9 root servers in that place, right, around the Bay Area. And I don't think they need 9 root servers there, but probably the root servers are there because it's really easy for a root server in the Bay Area, plenty of bandwidth and all that. So you'll need to have that trade-off. And the reason people have a lot of root servers in that region is when I talk to them, it's, oh, well, but I think half the world still goes through packs for the internet bandwidth, or half the world still transfers their, exchange their traffic for the rest of the world from the Bay Area. So all the Asian traffic is going to Bay Area, European traffic is also going to Bay Area, probably a lot of African traffic is going to Bay Area, so it makes sense for us to have it there. So that's the logic that people present. So that kind of makes sense. So you'll have to look at, where, how, what makes sense on where you place these things. Lower initial costs sometimes lead implementers to compromise by deploying more servers in existing location, which is less efficient. So this is what I was talking about the Bay Area. A lot of people tend to put things where it is easier to put things, but that might not actually, help the internet audience at all. The other things that you can actually think about is, now when you're designing a DNS server, which has to be Anycasted, there are ways in which you can do it. And I'll highly recommend you go and read the draft that I mentioned earlier. Generally, a couple of things like DNS resolution failover, long-lived connection-oriented flows, and identifying which server is actually giving the end user trouble. Right? So these are three things that I generally see coming out of people deploying Anycast. So the first thing is DNS resolution failover. So if you know how DNS works, it'll go and query the root, it'll go to the next authoritative server, find the list of servers that will reply authoritatively to your domain, and then go and, do a query for the resolver and store it in the cache, right? So say, for example, you've got 14 instances of fruit all over the world or 30 instances of something. But if the closest instance of the fruit is offline, right, then the resolver will have no way of saying that, oh, there is an fruit right next to me, which is closer to me, right? So take, for example, I'm from Kathmandu, right? So my satellite connection goes to Hong Kong and Singapore, right? But if my resolver fails to reach the fruit in Hong Kong, it will not go and find the fruit in Singapore. Instead, it will go and start looking for a different set of root server. It will think that, okay, fruit has failed. I'll go and try something else, right? Whereas if you look at the topography, the fruit in Singapore is the next closest root server to me from where I'm sitting. So that is you can't really do anything with that. Only solution is I'll tell other people, oh, tell I or K guys to put servers in Hong Kong and Singapore because these are hubs in Asia. But when you're designing your own network, generally it is good, right? So if you have ns4.abc.com and ns5.abc.com, you might want to put these two in a different set of Anycast, you know, cluster. Or maybe serve both of them from the same, you know, set of clusters so that even if one server fails, there is next one which is close enough. Right? So you'll have to look at how this overlapping works, and it is mainly up to the operator. Because you can tweak things in the routing part, but you really can't change the way resolvers work with DNS. So that is one thing. I said there is both servers are in fact hosted in the same Anycast cloud. The resolver will wind up talking to the same instance again, right? But if the same server fails, then it will not go back to the same server. It will try to reach a different server. And it makes sense for you to put a different NS server closer to the resolver than putting it far away. So best practice for Anycast DNS operations indicate a need for two separate overlapping cloud of Anycast servers. So that is one of the things that you can do to make your DNS more resilient, is to have two set of Anycast servers or two. I'm speaking too fast, that's what I'm being told from the back, so I'll try to speak slowly again. long-lived connections, especially TCP connections, or you know, interactive logins, they actually might, you know, retain state more than the underlying infrastructure. I don't know how many times you have been on this, but I've been on, you know, slow connections that is flapping all the time, and things like that, but my SSH connection actually stays stable, even when the connection actually flaps. Right? So I might go off the internet, come back because the wireless has flapped, but even after 10 minutes, my SSH session is still stable. I can still go back and don't have to, you know, re-log in. So some of these protocols are more resilient than the underlying infrastructure itself. So with Anycast, especially when you're using TCP, then you run into these problems. As I said, there might be a routing change somewhere between you and the Anycasted servers, and then, you know, the addresses might change, the routing might change. So you might be in a case where you're sending one packet to one server and another packet to a different server because the routing had changed. So that is one thing that come up, and there is... There's no really a way in which you can maintain this. One way that people do with HTTP addresses, or one way in which people actually avoid this problem, is when you actually get a request to a service address, the reply is actually sent from the interface address, especially when it is HTTP server or something, so that the state that is maintained, the TCP state is maintained with the interface address, which means that it is always a unique address that is serving the client. And if the state goes down, the Ethernet interface or the access interface goes offline, and then you have to go and create a new connection to a different server elsewhere. So in that case, the client is not under the assumption that it is connecting to the same server again at a different location. So that is one way when people have done it, but a lot of research by a lot of people have actually shown that this is of less frequent occurrence than we are talking about, which I have my own doubts because of the place I live in and the kind of connectivity I am on. But a lot of research have shown that this problem is less likely to occur if you have engineered your network properly. And as I said, with DNS and UDP, this is very less likely, and that's why we see a lot more DNS anycast at server, and only a few big content providers doing anycast. The third problem that we commonly see is identifying the problematic server instance. Right? So the client would say, your DNS server is not running, or I can't access the web server. What do I do? So you can't really tell which server is actually giving the problem, right? Because they'll just say, I'm getting trouble with the fruit. Which fruit? Where is the fruit? Right? You never know where your traffic is going to, because we had this. I can show you the trace in the break time. We installed an instance of an iRoot server in Kathmandu. So before we installed the server, I run the exchange point, so I have to do a report to my members saying, this is the difference in the kind of connection. One of my ISP, one of my upstream, and the trace to the iRoot server landed up in Turkey after going through London, west coast of the US, east coast of the US, Europe, and then back to Turkey. And then I said, this is very bad. This is not fine. This should not be happening. I'll do another trace from a different upstream. So I went through a different upstream, and from Singapore, it went all the way to US west coast and came back and ended up in Bangkok. Right? And I talked with the iRoot people, and they said, both these addresses are not supposed to be globally routable. We don't know what's the problem. Right? So if somebody was complaining to them saying, oh, we are getting really bad instance problem with the iRoot, then they really don't know where it's being served from. And you know, that is something that is still discussed. But then the most simple way to find the problematic instance is, again, to do a trace. So when you do a trace, you see the immediate next hop router address, and you know exactly where it is. And especially if you are doing DNS, then you can put a text in the SOA records indicating where it is. Or you know, put it in the bind information so that when you do a query, you can actually find out exactly where that thing is. With the fruit and iRoot, I think if you do a dig for chaos.txt, then it'll actually tell you where that server is actually located. So, but this is one of the other problems with customers and ISPs, help desks not being able to handle that situation where you know they really don't know where the server is. There's some security ramifications as well. One of the reasons the root servers are so widely anycasted is they are trying to avoid DOS attacks, right? Non-distributed DOS. If it is a distributed DOS, then maybe a lot of servers would actually get hit. And that's probably a good idea. Instead of one server getting hit with a DDoS, you can have multiple servers getting hit. But if you have a DOS attack originating from a single point, it'll probably go and hit one server located somewhere without affecting other servers. But then again, it has to be a conscious decision on the part of the operator to say that, okay, if I'm getting hit by a DOS, then I'm also going to sync all the legitimate traffic that is coming to this instance. Right, so there's still a trade-off on the part of the operator of the server to decide, well, you know, if there's 1% of legitimate requests coming to the server and 99% of it is a DOS, then I'll sync everything and not worry about the 1% of the people. So that is, again, a trade-off that people have to look at. So, you know, handling DOS and DDoS is something that Anycast helps with by also distributing the target, not just the source of attack. Right, Anycast basically distributes the target, so slightly helpful. Okay, the last slide I have is some recap. And I had a lot more details on this here, which I removed, and I'm happy to talk about that. But when you do announce multiple same prefixes from multiple locations with a no export community tagged, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't really work, right? A lot of operators actually say that you have to put a no export tag, but I don't think that's a, I think that's actually a bad idea, because as the iRoot traces showed, no export didn't really work. And I was getting, you know, trace routes into Turkey and Bangkok, which are not supposed to be nodes that are visible outside of Thailand and Turkey. So maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. And there's a lot of discussion going on it. A lot of people actually announce a covering route so that, you know, service addresses not become completely unavailable. Because sometimes what happens is you have a no export tag, so the ISPs won't export it to the customer, and then it gets blackballed within the network. And that happened with the K route and they started announcing a covering prefix so that, you know, people are still able to access it globally even if the Anycaster instance is getting blackballed somewhere. So I think there's work being done by the NCC, RIPE NCC on that, and there was some discussion on the nano mailing list a couple of months ago on that. And definitely, I think the NCC is doing a lot of measurements and instrumentation of the effect of the K-root Anycast. And if you want to see some of those, go to the RIPE 52, 53 couple of weeks ago. 52, there was a presentation on the K-root measurements of traffic and K-root distribution. So you can go and read that. But this is something that is up for discussion, and I frankly think it's a bad idea to actually do no export, because you are introducing another statement there which complicates the routing, and it's not necessarily works all the time. Any questions? I'm sure we'll have a lot of questions here.
It stays on? Okay. When you were talking about TCP, you were talking about the server, Anycast server, responding with its interface address instead of its Anycast address. That sounds to me like in the like DNS UDP case that the server sends its reply sourced from the Anycast address. Is that true?
Yes, that is one of the ways people use to work around the limitations of, you know, having the failover not working.
Okay. If the servers, Anycast servers, are normally going to respond from the Anycast address, that means that all the routers in the network have to pass IP datagrams sourced from Anycast address. That makes things like BCP38 and access control pretty much moot, because I can just generate all those attacks from some other Anycast address.
Can you repeat that again?
Suppose I want to attack a DNS server, like Joe Abley was talking about. Suppose I need to spoof source addresses. Why don't I spoof the source address as an Anycast address? In practice, routers in the network, in order to prevent that kind of thing, are going to have to prevent Anycast addresses of any class from appearing in the source address of any routed packet.
If somebody is spoofing the IP address, even Anycasted or non-Anycasted, that can still happen. So I don't see a problem with that. Yes, Bill, something?
Sorry. That sort of seemed like two questions. And the second question about spoofing, there's no difference between an address that's being used for Anycast and any other address. If you're getting transit for them, they can be permitted by that transit provider and not by others. If you're peering with people, those peers can filter in exactly the same way they would with any other address. On the first question about TCP, it's not that you have a query coming, a query going to one address and a response coming back from a different one. It's that typically you issue a redirect to the client, and then the client will go out to the address it's been redirected to, which is a unique address rather than a shared address.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. And that's the case. If somebody is spoofing traffic, spoofing IP address, then you know it's either Anycaster or not Anycaster. It really doesn't make a difference. Is still being spoofed. So, and if the spoof traffic is being passed through the upstream or routers, then there's not much you can do about it. You had a question, yes.
How do you deal with the challenges of load balancing between the two clusters?
That is something that will, you know, that you really can't say. That's what I said. You have to put your servers closer to the population which is going to access it and hope that the routing will take care of sending the traffic to the right place. Right? There is no real way that you can determine saying that, okay, you know, I want queries to go to this particular address and not to this particular address. So you really don't have control over that. Only way to do that will be to put more instances closer to the population that is going to use it. Right? And then, of course, if you have multiple servers in the same cluster, then you can use round-robin DNS or round-robin on the IGP2 load balance between the two instances. That is fine. But if you are putting servers in multiple cities, load balancing between them is something that will leave up to the routing system. So go out and peer widely at each location. Try to peer as widely as possible with your target customers, you know, maybe by transit from people who won't peer with you but serve your target customers. That will help. But there's no really a trick or a way to actually load balance between multiple anycasted location. It's just that if one fails, the other will still serve queries, right? You'll have a resiliency in the network, but you only can hope that the routing will make sure that you've got peering at both locations. So sometimes that is important to know is when you are having multiple anycast clusters, and if you are peering with people, you want to peer with people everywhere as much as possible. Otherwise, you'll get into exit problems about, normally providers will keep a higher local pref for their customers and then put their peers in the medium range and put the transit links as the highest cost exit path. So if you peer with someone somewhere and not peer with the same guy elsewhere, then you might get into this exit problem where the where they route traffic differently. So when you're doing that, you want to peer with everyone as much as possible everywhere so that your traffic is distributed properly.
Gaurav, you mean topologically closer, not geographically closer?
No, topographically closer, yes. Now, geography doesn't really make a lot of sense here. As I said, I'm topographically closer to Hong Kong and Singapore than I am to India, so right, it has to be topography, not really geography.
What is the advantage of DNS anycast over mirroring?
Mirroring?
Yes.
You mean having more secondaries?
Yes.
If you can only have 13 secondaries in a DNS system, right? You cannot have more than 13 secondaries. So you can actually have 13 secondaries. And then beyond that, if you want to grow beyond that, the only way you can actually grow is to put anycast servers around. It's not really a good way to say that it works. So if you cross the limitation of 13 servers, and then you still want more servers around, 13, 14, I think it's 13, limited to 13. So I see Randy waving his head. Yeah, that's what it is. So you can have, with the existing 512 byte UDP packets, you can have, I think, 13 plus a couple of more.
Hello.
Ah, yes.
Redundancy is a good thing. Depending upon the length of... this is Randy Bush, IJ. Depending, and I wish other people would say their name and affiliation, especially for, recording and this is being streamed. The number you may have depends upon the length of the name servers. So if the name servers were... 1.rg.net, 2.rg.net, etc. You could have more than 13.
Thank you. You need to fit everything within the 512 byte packet. That's it. Not really limited to 13. You can have 13 plus 2 or 3 V6 and so on. Yes, Bill?
Bill Woodcock with PCH. I think it's important to point out that this is not a substitution question. It's not a question of more secondaries or anycast. Almost always you're doing both. Anycast works together with a lot of other load balancing methods, and typically a well-designed Anycast deployment will take advantage of other load balancing methods like client resolver failover, for instance. So you would have several different IP addresses that you were anycasting from different sites. And if a client was getting bad performance from one anycast site, it could fail over under its own control to a different IP address, which would then go out to a different anycast site. So you'd be using both of those together.
Well, one thing that I kind of missed out on my slides is, for an ISP within a network, anycast can be useful within an IGP more than with BGP. You can actually have one DNS server throughout your network anycasted really widely at each of your POPs. So, well, when we are using BGP, then you anycast a whole /24 or /23, right, so that it works on the BGP network, but you can inject an IGP anycasted route, a /32 within your own IGP, and use that for Radius and AAA and DNS servers within your own network. And that is what is more useful for ISPs internally in the network, is inject a /32 into the IGP so that, you know, wherever your customers are, they go to the closest DNS server within your own network. So ISPs do that quite a lot. Right? So that is something that, you know, even if you place a lot of secondaries, that really won't get people to that server that you want. So that is some of the things. But as Bill said, these are not mutually exclusive. You need anycasted servers if you want a lot of redundancy. But as I said earlier, you probably want to anycast two different set of secondaries in an overlapping crowd so that the performance is still better than, you know, completely if completely going offline or something like that. Okay, yes, there. I think
one more question.
Regarding the routing for anycast, it appears to me like you pretty much are going to give up control, because you may know that for certain clients, they are closer to a specific DNS server, but now because we have left everything under the control of BGP, I can imagine instances where the BGP metrics for certain service address happen to be the same, in which case BGP is going to load balance. Okay. Because we are learning the service addresses through BGP, I can imagine situations where these service addresses are coming into the BGP table with same metrics values. So from a BGP perspective, these are addresses that are equally reachable. But you know yourself as an administrator to say, even though these are coming with the same BGP metrics, this particular server is actually topologically, and if you consider other features, maybe like bandwidth and so on, it's the better one for this particular client to reach. But because we've left it to be done dynamically, BGP.
Well, in a case where your router is seeing the same prefix from two different sources with equal password, I think you're mentioning, right?
Yes.
Right. So generally, unless he's getting it from two different transit providers, there can be a couple of scenarios. The question is, what happens if a BGP table or a router is in two parts with the same cost in the routing table, right? So there are many ways in which this can happen. A, he's buying transit from two different providers, right? And both of them are actually supplying the prefix to them. So it's probably going to be his decision to do traffic shifting between one or the other provider. That is one way, right? B, he can be getting it through peering and through the transit provider, in which case the ISP on the other side will decide where the traffic is going. But yeah, you are right in the sense that, yes, you leave the control up to BGP to do its work, right? But then how is that different when you just have a unicasted service address?
How is
it different when it is only a unicast service address?
Well,
where BGP is still doing its work.
No, what I was trying to... I was trying to imagine a case where, because you know specifically which one is the better service to reach, if you gain an advantage by doing simple static routing by pointing to the different service addresses, because you know for sure which one is your preferable against the other ones.
Well, in that case, you can ask them to put local prep or some other BGP knobs to make sure that the traffic goes to you. And that's it. I mean, address complaining about no export, people try to use that so that it is not propagated widely. But sometimes you still see these problems. And then the only way is to work with the person who is reporting the problem to say, can you local pay one particular set of files over the other? So that if you use static and then if that server goes off, then you can't really reach it, even through the secondary path. So probably a better idea is to use BGP knobs to select which path you want. I think but.
Okay, thanks. I think you two can sit on the same table at lunchtime to finish that one out. let's have a round of applause for Gaurav. Thank you very much. Our next presenter is Segi, and she's going to talk about IPv6. Segi has 6 years of technical support organization, mainly focusing on in the US on NRENs. And this year we've started working with NRENs of AFNOG. I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about that. We had a good, interesting 2 days over the last weekend on this issue. And she's also worked with large ISPs and large enterprises. Segi Baini, thank you. I think this is your first AFNOG, but I'm sure we'll see you more.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here. I didn't expect this many turnouts, but it's a pleasant thing to watch. When I was preparing for this presentation, in order to give a global view, I contacted various people. Latif IPv6 workshop, IPv6 working group, and also Jim, to kind of give me an overview of the state of affairs for IPv6. After going through that, basically what I have decided to do is give you our own deployment experience, what we have already watched over the years. When I joined Cisco 6 years ago, one of the first accounts that I was supporting was Internet 2, their backbone network. And Internet 2 was involved with one of the first EFT, early field trial for IPv6. So the first major IPv6 deployment in U.S. backbone-wise was Abilene on our GSR routers. So since then, we have kind of fanned out to regional networks. Basically, Abilene interconnects all these regional networks to provide them the national transit between among research universities. So I have that experience, and also I have now, because of the government mandates in U.S. to deploy all the federal network being mandated to deploy IPv6, we've started to work with federal government. I have also my colleagues who have a global view, Patrick Grosset, probably some of you may know. There are also some engineers who, Chip, for example, who is involved with cable provider IPv6 deployment. So I gathered all that information to kind of give you how we're viewing the IPv6 progression in globally support-wise. The agenda that we're going to take a look at is, first of all, why IPv6? What are the drivers? Even these have changed over the year. Like, for example, in 2001, 2002, the major driver varied globally. For example, in the U.S., it's been just education and research network. And Asia-Pac, address availability and consumer electronics, etc. But now even that has changed the driver. So I'm going to talk about basically by customer segment, what's driving the ISP, what's driving the cable provider, and what's driving the NRENs, and also talk about guiding principles that it's good to follow when considering deployment of IPv6, and then talk about kind of best experience deployment approaches, talk about specific case studies in the customer sector that I have talked about, ISP, cable provider, and NREN, and then the conclusion. Why IPv6 is basically enable new service for NREN, innovate, protocol improvement, work with standard bodies. You know, this has been happening for a long time, and it is going to continue to be that way. Depletion of global IPv4 address. Well, you know, many people have predicted when that's going to happen, depletion of IPv4. I'm not going to argue about that when it's going to happen, but I think we all agree that, you know, over time it's going to happen. So you're going to wait until it happens, or you're going to think about it now and kind of proactively position yourself to take advantage of it and be positioned. Customers are going through their ISPs and demanding IPv6 services. In US, at least, that's the case because of the federal government, and also some universities, because right now they can go have their own IPv6 address /32 and site. That wasn't used to be the case. They want to be provider independent, and they're going to their ISP and asking for IPv6 services. Insufficient address pool of RFC 1918 private address. I'll talk about a specific case study, but we have also seen that you know, specific cable providers who are running out of the private address space and taking a look at IPv6 provisioning and deployment. I sort of divided argument and practice. Actually, I like I borrowed this slide from a colleague of mine because I like the way it's laid out, argument and then practice. Like I said earlier, not enough private address. There's a specific MSO cable provider that we are working with who is having 100 million address space requirement, and they basically run out of the private address and their class A address, and they are looking at deploying IPv6. Basically, they have IPv6 address assignment requirement for every cable modem and every set boxes, etc. Also, some mobile providers, not in US, but somewhere in Asia, who have address large address requirement, who's testing IPv6 to deploy in their core. Large enterprise, this is a large retail, mainly based in US, but expanding into Asia and Europe, also considering deployment of IPv6, mainly for address availability. Another thing that's developing in terms of deployment of IPv6 is a new service, being able to deploy new service, and that is basically in the entertainment, being able to provide content. And what a particular service provider has done was, you know, instead of doing IPv4 multicast over PPP on broadband, which has, you know, identified some scalability issues, is to be able to do the content fanning out using IPv6 multicast. So what are the guiding principles when you are taking a look at IPv6 deployment? First of all, if you have a production network that's already running and you have service level agreement with your customer, and when you deploy any new service, regardless of what it is you don't want to impact your production network in any way. You want to minimize any kind of adverse operation regarding your production network. That's the first thing you need to watch out. Also, I think, from Cisco perspective, for example, our product feature availability requires about 2 years kind of planning and implementation. I think Benoit can talk to that. Because of that, you want to be able to talk to your vendor in terms of what kind of feature you have, so the vendor can kind of plan what kind of feature you're looking at, so you can evolve with their plan. And when you are ready to deploy, your vendor is also ready with the feature availability. You don't want to be able to, you don't want to say, "Oh, I need this feature now," and not be able to be supported by your vendor. And all this is, we've gathered this based on deployment experience and kind of, this is not an exhaustive list, but it's kind of best practice based on what we have seen. So perspectives from, when you talk to network manager, his infrastructure focus, what's going to affect his core. From end user perspective, it's application focus, what's supported on the network, and basically the preferred way is that application should be IP agnostic. It shouldn't care whether it's IPv6 or IPv4. It should just run. I can't emphasize enough the need for training. When we first started deploying IPv6, there was a lot of fear factor. Suddenly, people not realizing it's just an IP, but with a large address space, 128 bits kind of was scary, and there was a lot of resistance to deploying IPv6. So training overcomes that, and also creating a small test environment and playing with, hands-on and playing with different kind of transition mechanisms, so you understand how it works and how it applies to your own network when you're ready to deploy. Considering there are many various transition mechanisms, what applies to your network. This is kind of a list that I made up. It's not an exhaustive list, but kind of an overview. The first thing is you need to obtain IPv6 address space /32. I think we covered it in the workshop day before yesterday. There's really no cost to you. It's very easy, and it's available. I think you need to take advantage of it. Just obtain /32. Take it, but don't sit on it either. Just try to do minimal kind of deployment is what I personally recommend. Devise an IPv6 address plan like the gentleman who presented in the morning. You have heard him saying that their IPv6 IPv4 addressing scheme initially was not very well thought out, but I think you need to sit down and devise your IPv6 addressing scheme. Then study all available tools, network management, monitoring, and establish operational procedure. Here, what I really recommend is that SixNet, an European IPv6 project that was been put in place by European Commission and interconnecting European NRANs. It's no longer operational, but there's a lot of intellectual property that was obtained by over 3 years' experience. If you go to www.sixnet.org, there's a lot of reference material and best practice and management tool, etc., and operation, network operation best practice that you can take advantage of by taking a look. I mean, there are a lot of research organization, government, and private corporation participate in contributing to this intellectual property. Since there are many participants, it's kind of divided by work packages, like work package zero overlooks all project activities. Cisco is also a major partner in that effort. Work package one takes a look at network operation aspect of IPv6, 2, and routing, DNS, QoS, multicast. All the information that you can find there is very, very useful, and I really encourage you to start looking at that to gain kind of a lot of experience and skills. Select appropriate transition path for your own environment that is gained, you know, through the skills and reading and playing with IPv6 and really understanding your own network environment and determining what kind of transition tool would be appropriate for your own network. The next thing is selecting appropriate routing protocol. If you are running OSPF version 2 for IPv4 and you want to do OSPF version 3 for IPv6, it's basically ship in the night. If you want to do ISIS, is a multi-protocol, is just one. Of course, as you know, ISIS does carry IPv4, IPv6, and CLNS, so you have one integrated routing protocol. So it's all your choice. I mean, understanding various options and determining what best fit your staff skill set and your environment. Then there are other transition aids like 6 to 4 bandwidth. There are just various 6 to 4 relay, for example, is one transition mechanism that you can take a look while, you know, before deploying IPv6 natively. And then, you know, DNS, QoS, multicast is advanced services that you take a look at after you deploy your unicast in your environment. For this, again, you know, I can't emphasize enough, there are multiple best practices and how to deploy this on the SixNet archive page. We also want to do IPv6 readiness assessment, and that is, you know, routers have certain memory and certain CPU capacity. You may want to query your network and understand what kind of memory capacity and CPU you have to kind of do another image, load another image that supports IPv6. There are, you know, services available to be able to help you out with that if you don't want to do it on your own. But I just want to mention that it kind of important to kind of segment your network, host, what are the host requirements and what's the network requirement, and kind of phase it in as opposed to kind of drop it in like a flag day. So in terms of NRAN, that's like one of the first IPv6 deployment anywhere, actually. You know, over the years, I have watched it. So, you know, IPv6, not just, you know, NRAN gigs playing with IPv6, but this is really, a viable services. But it started in NREN. Typically, they deploy dual stack in the core. And if the regional network, was kind of slow picking up IPv6 initially, so what happens is a campus to regional aggregation point is a configured tunnel to transport IPv6 over IPv4, and then the core is dual stack. That was basically the strategy that was followed pretty much even up to now. There are almost all NRENs now are IPv6 native. There is one or two in the U.S., maybe one, that's not IPv6 capable, and that's also changing now because they're doing some project with Department of Energy who's telling them that you have to do IPv6 in order to participate in the project. So that's the kind of movement we're seeing. Same operational model like IPv4. There's really nothing special that you, in terms of NOC operation practice, that you do for IPv4. That you do for IPv4, so you don't for IPv6. MSO. This is basically a cable provider space. Who was looking at IPv6 deployment due to address availability, setbacks, and cable modems, IPv6 capable. So their strategy is new devices which are being produced, like cable modems, are IPv6 only, and IPv4 only modems, legacy modems, are already in place. So the CMTS, the termination point for cable modems, has some sort of translation mechanism to do translation from IPv4 to IPv6. And their strategy is basically, first, they're not going to touch any services in the core, but just use IPv6 for management purposes of these devices. So the strategy is access to core. IPv6 only in the access, and then dual stack in the core. So this is basically summarizing the address-driven approach, like I've discussed: cable modem, setbacks, address, and solution is IPv6 that they have decided to deploy. Sorry for this is the bright color. This is basically working with a cable provider. It's kind of a schematic, you know, easy to remember, kind of block by block, you know, scope. Like I said, you know, do your network assessment, design plan, deploy unicast IPv6 initially, and then deploy, you know, if necessary, multicast to do content provision. This is specifically for a service provider who's doing content provision in Asia. And based on the experience, kind of a timeline that took, going between, you know, a scope plan design to actually deploying services, kind of to give you an idea, a time frame. A specific ISP that's doing IPv6 services now, who has a /21, and they assign /32 per countries, and /40 per site, and /48 per customer. And all links, whether it's point-to-point or broadcast media, gets /64. This is basically the same addressing plan allotment in the NREN space. Usually, like if you take Abilene, for example, they assign /40 for regional network, and then each regional network to assign /48 for each campuses and universities attached to the regional network. And all links get /64. Of course, deployment is not going to be IPv6 overnight. I think in our lifetime we're going to see coexistence. And in my opinion, I don't think it's going to be a flag day. We're still seeing SNA. I used to work for IBM, and we still see some SNA in the network. We still see some IPX. So it's going to be IPv4 and IPv6 coexistence for a period of time. I have already mentioned the service-driven aspect for the service provider who's a content provider using IPv6 multicast. So this is basically saying that you take a look at the long term. Start thinking about it today and do the necessary preparation, training, small-scale testing, and understanding it thoroughly before deploying in the network. And engage your vendors from, early on, so you get your feature set built into their schedule. This is basically saying the same thing that I have said earlier, but specifically for cable provider. These are the reference. I have mentioned earlier, 6net.org is the best, in my opinion, to go for some references. I want to be able to show you. So my last comment is, IPv6 is not an overnight thing. It's an evolution. So you really need to start thinking about it now and get your address space. And I want to go show you something. I think picture speaks, better than 1 million words. So I want to be able to show you something from the resource page. Here is how the IPv6 allotment looks like today. This information is current as of March 2006, and as you see, RIPE NCC is by far way ahead of the rest of the regions. LACNIC is 56. I think Jordi can confirm if that's an up-to-date information. This is as of March 2006, and he will tell you, LACNIC went from very handful to overnight 56, that's an excellent progress. You see ARIN and EPNIC also is a fair size. As you see, AFRINIC here has 1% allotment and only 13. So next year, by this time, it would be very important for us to double that number at least. So with that, I close my presentation.
My name is John Walubingo, KCCT. I'm a bit not too convinced about the need for IP version 6. I mean, the fact that IP version 4 is running out has really not made me want to go to IP version 6. Could you give us more tangible benefits for migrating to IP version 6? Because sometimes I think the technical people have a solution, and now they're looking for the problem with this IP version 6.
Well, I mean, it just depends who you are. I mean, if you are a cable broadband provider and you have multiple customers and you don't have address availability to cover all your customers and to be able to deliver services, yeah, I mean, like I said, all the drivers. But if you are comfortable and you don't foresee any kind of need for IPv6 and you're perfectly comfortable, you have a perfect vision of your future, you know, go ahead. Don't deploy IPv6.
Merci. Et je la remercie beaucoup pour sa présentation. Je suis Tchatchessi Soham, autorité de réglementation. Ah, ok, ok, ok. Je suis M. Tchatchessi Soham, autorité de réglementation du Togo. Bon, j'ai juste deux questions. C'est à titre de mieux comprendre les fondements de base de IPv6. La première question, c'est en termes de sécurité. J'aimerais savoir quels sont les apports de IPv6 en matière de sécurité. Est-ce qu'il y a des apports nouveaux par rapport à IPv4? Ma deuxième question est un peu liée. C'est bon? D'accord. Ma deuxième question est liée à la qualité de service. Et si j'ai pu bien comprendre, il y a un point où elle a fait allusion à une interconnexion régionale qui serait lente et basée sur de l'IPv4 pourrait être amélioré en utilisant de l'IPv6. J'aimerais savoir si le déploiement de IPv6 constitue une garantie éventuelle en matière de qualité de service. Merci.
Right. Thank you. I think I'll ask Benoit to summarize the question for us a bit so that it can be answered as well. Thanks.
So, Tsege, the two questions which have been asked by the Togo Regulatory Authority is first, is IPv6 is bringing some things in terms of security? And secondly, is IPv6 bringing something in terms of quality of service? What are the benefits of installing IPv6 in regard to those two subjects?
I wouldn't say if you deploy IPv6, your network is automatically secure and you offer better quality of service, but I would say that both of those things are not an afterthought like IPv4. After IPv4 protocol was designed, these things were taught after, and it's an add-on, whereas those items are already taught about, and it's part of the protocol, integrated in part of the protocol in IPv6. Benoit, you want to add something to that?
For the security item, what I would like to add is, as you are carefully planning your IPv4 security. Security for IPv6 is on the same vein. You'll need to carefully plan your IPv6 security. V4 and V6 are slightly different, and you'll need to learn how to secure your IPv6 network in the same way you learned how to secure your IPv4 network. There is no magic in it.
I've learned through the days I've been here that if you put up a case, you can get as many IPv4 IP addresses as you want for an institution or anything. But I'm also getting these issues about IPv6, that we have to move away from IPv4 to 6 to, get away the problem of depleting the IPv4. So I'm really not quite sure. If you can still get the IPv4 or as much addresses as you want, why should we move to IPv6?
Like I answered the question to the gentleman earlier, there is really no need to just for going to IPv6 for IPv6 sake. If you're satisfied with what services you're deploying in your network and IPv4 is sufficiently available for your network growth from now to whenever that depletion is occurring, then don't.
Oh, okay.
Adiel at Logan Afrinik. I would just like to make two comments about the previous question. One of the questions, the first question was, we have the problem and we are looking for another problem. I think that IPv6, it's an advanced protocol of IPv4. So as technical people, we have at least to look at how it works and be prepared. Even if you are not ready to deploy it today, it could be worth to know what it is about and be ready. As Benoit said before, planning is very important in network environment. So if you don't know what it is about, it will be difficult for you to plan it. Secondly, I think IPv6 is not only about the number of IP addresses, it's also about future. IPv6 has some future, which of course we have on IPv4, but may be more easy when you know how to deal with them to implement. So it's a whole thing, and it's very important for our community here to start looking at IPv6. We don't want, again, to be the last one joining the wagon. It's worth for us to start looking at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One comment and two questions. When I saw the title of the presentation, to be honest, I was expecting to get some information about the ongoing project. I understand that the update is very important to have explanation about how the protocol is working. But I wonder at that stage, after 10 years of implementation in different part of the world, like if I refer to the European environment where the European community have endorsed at the higher end political level that they're going to push for the IPv6, they go through a process of trying to implement process of awareness and doing a lot of things that was a European project for IPv6. The same thing happened also in LACNIC, where the in the Latin and Caribbean environment, where the LACNIC was supporting also the various project on IPv6, and I think that there was some endorsement also at a higher and political level also. So my question here is, we have a very young institution that is AfriNIC that is doing a lot of things on that side. If there is any ongoing project relating to IPv6 where they have some commitment at a higher level or with various countries to implement it. Why I am asking that question, I remember in Senegal, we just tried to talk 2 years ago to the telecom operator, trying to talk to him about doing some tests, because at that time there were some tests going between Senegal and the French network on IPv6. But the answer of the telecom operator at that time is, we're not interested, you have to convince us to move ahead on it. I mean, we're an ISP, we're a telecom operator, we see no market for it, so we're not going to invest anything unless we see something really concrete going on there. So I really wanted to know if there is any initiative at the regional level endorsed by AfriNIC or any African institution in order to help the continent move forward on the step of awareness and at the very high level political stage, so to see that people are trying to move on it. Thank you.
Yeah, as part of the question was directed to AfriNIC. I cannot answer for the government at the high level, but I can say some initiative we have. At AfriNIC, last year, those who were at AfriNIC 2 meeting remember that we had a long discussion on IPv6, what AfriNIC can do. Based on those discussions, we took the initiative of improving awareness on IPv6. We had in December last year the first African IPv6 meeting in Cairo, where we had more than 60 people from different countries in Africa sharing their experience on IPv6. This was preceded by an IPv6, the first IPv6 hands-on, which happened here also. The third one happened here Saturday. So we are trying to increase the awareness or to raise the awareness on IPv6. And one of the goals we have is that everywhere we have the hands-on, we try to set up an IPv6 connectivity. And I can tell you that after the training we had last Saturday, today there is a live IPv6 connection to Kenya. We had the training in Sudan. We had the same thing in Sudan, same in Cairo. So one thing that we as AfriNIC we can do is to at least toward the operator raise the awareness. We had a discussion with some high-level authority during the WSIS process to have a continental initiative to raise awareness in a more general way on IPv6. And there is a project called Six Mandela. I don't know if some of you hear about it, which is an ongoing project to work on IPv6. It's not completely ready yet, but some government already express their interest in participating in that project. So that is it. Thanks.
Yeah, I more than a question, I would like to make a couple of comments. Basically, when we are asking about the need or not of IPv6, it's true that we have a lot of IPv4 addresses still. So it's not really a question about needing more addresses immediately, but looking into the medium long term. And obviously, when you start deploying any new technology, sometimes you can do it overnight, sometimes you need to do planning, and that may take years, especially for big ISPs. So that's the first question. The second question is, or the second point is, IPv6 is not just about having more addresses. It's just about having addresses that allow you end-to-end communication and consequently innovation. And that brings to the response to the question about why deploying IPv6. Well, maybe you need to consider the cost of NAT. This is a hidden cost that most of the time we don't see. And there was in the NANOC meeting in Los Angeles last October, an important operator, American Online, that speak up in the mic and said, look, every time I need to provide the support, I need to support a customer call, I lose, because they're not, I lose the profit of that customer for 1 year. If I need to bring this support call to a second level engineer, I lose the customer profit for the entire life of the customer. And if you look at this said by an operator like American Online, I think it's quite serious. It's not somebody promoting IPv6. It's a reality. It's a reality that most of the time is hidden. We are not looking at. If you look at the developers of applications, developing applications that need to do peer-to-peer traversing NAT is not that easy and usually cost a lot of money. So that's what about IPv6 is it. It's about making sure that you can make this innovation end-to-end without having a lot of trouble and asking the developers to take care of things like managing NATs. I think with that we are basically answering several of the questions. Then the point about when you need to start deploying IPv6, again, it's a question of planning, but it's a question also of competition in the market. There is more and more people that is deploying IPv6 everywhere. It's happening already in Africa. And if you don't deploy IPv6, maybe you are not getting immediate business with IPv6, but definitively you can start losing business because your competitors are already doing it. That's a very important point. Just to finish, I want to state something. Everyone that we helped here in Africa and the rest of the world to get an IPv6 prefix got IPv6 deployed in just days or weeks. You can guess that that means it's not so difficult, it's not so costly. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I think let's take a few comments very quickly. I think Randy has something at back.
Let's see if I can work the technology. Yeah, this is Randy Bush, IIJ. Indeed, you can get the address and you can deploy it very quickly. So what's the rush? I have enough to do. I need to do something profitable. I work in Japan. I work in the first and largest deployer of IPv6. By largest, I mean very tiny. Right? IPv6 is doubling every week. We now have 8. IPv6, it's like, you know, they say democracy, although right now in the United States that may not be the best example, but democracy is not very good, but it's the best thing we have. IPv6 may be the only path forward we have, but do it when it makes economic sense for you. There's plenty of other things to do, and Jordi, you know I hate NATs more than you do, but unfortunately, one of the major IPv6 transition schemes they're coming up with is NAT. Shoot this stuff.
Thank you, Randy. Mohammed, please.
Thank you. I just want to come back on one thing that Agile have tried to cover by giving the explanation about the experimentation that is going on. I don't think that it was only for AfriNIC to answer the question I was trying to raise, because the problem I was trying to raise is first for us to understand that if we want that to push for it, we are not the only people on board. What I'm trying to express is here in Africa, the biggest networks we got are operated by the telecom operators, and these people are not associated, I mean, most of them, with the initiative we are trying to do. So my concern is how is AFNOC is able, I'm not saying that it's only, AFNOC can say yes, can say no, but is that anything we can do in order to structure the discussion that have to be done between all the parties involved in the network infrastructure? I mean, now it become regulators and telecom operators and ISP. But we're still in the ISP environment, and we try to solve the problem. I give you some example in the West African region. the ISPs did not run the networks. They have a small part of the network that is this part. I mean, the other part is almost run by telecom operators, and they are not involved in the process. So what I'm saying is, if we want to push for a sustainable development of IPv6, we need to structure the discussion we have and try to create and initiate other fora. I don't know what sort, but what happened in different continents is not a myth. I mean, we can create it, but it's not just by doing one training per year or by discussion just at the AFNOG meeting that we will harness the development of the IPv6. That was the message I have.
Thanks, Matt. I think on that one, being that we're running out of time and you've raised some good issues, I'll use that famous thing. Let's park it and we'll figure out something in the afternoon to fit it in. We have some space where we can get that answered. I'd like to thank all the presenters this morning. Thank you very much. We've actually covered quite a lot of interesting topics. Lunch is being served by the poolside, and somebody at the door will be giving you lunch coupons as you go out. Thank you for being a good audience. This is me signing out, and in the afternoon, Mr. Didier Kasole will be your session chair. And thank you again. Bye. Have a good lunch. Can I please remind you to take your laptops? Or else somebody might borrow them. We will be locking the room, but I'd like to ask you to actually take your laptop if you can. If it's easier for you, can we all leave the room once and then we'll lock it and open it later?